Okay, so 31st of August 2005, Jamie Andrews talking to Peter Nichols in his house in North London for the University of Sheffield British Library Theatre Archive project. Peter, we're going to start by talking about your early experiences of performance, and you've written about going to the pantomime at Christmas and the circus in the summer. What do you remember still about these? What was it that attracted you?
I think it was the glamorous feeling when the circus arrived, because Bertram Mills Circus, which was the big circus at the time, used to arrive at the local station, the local railway station, with all their players, all their cast and their company and all their animals, and they'd come out of the local, the suburban railway station and parade along our street, our suburban street, to go to the common where they had their big tent, and they were going to play for a week or fortnight or however long it was. And so you'd look out of the window of our suburban, that bay window, you know, of our suburban house, and find a camel nibbling the hedge, girls waving from elephants and horses prancing and all that. And it was simply marvellous, that was. And it was the occasion, the sense of occasion and glamour and glitter, and then the ordinary common on which we normally played suddenly became this glamorous place with the tents, the huge big top and the lights and the noise and all that. And then you walk in up this sawdust trail through this aisle of tents on either side with girls shouting. I mean, I've done it since. It's still done. Some of the circuses still have that sort of atmosphere when they come to town, but of course, it doesn't work for me anymore because I'm a nearly 80-year-old man, so it's a bit different from being an 8-year-old boy. But that's how it must have been up till the advent of war, I suppose. And then the other one that you mentioned was the pantomime, which came at Christmas, and we would go to usually the Prince's Theatre, which was bombed early in the war, so that was the end of that. And they're still doing pantomimes at the other theatre, the Hippodrome, and the Theatre Royal, which is the Old Vic. But this is in Bristol, of course, and that was how it was then. And the pantomime was equally glamorous with all its flying ballets and its people dressed as animals and, you know, clowns and stuff. And it was those elements, those almost tatty sort of apparatus of circus and pantomime that initially attracted me, long before I became aware that theatre could be more than that.
That's interesting that you say it's tatty. Do you think you were aware at the time that you could see almost behind the glamour and glitz of this, or is that something that now you look back?
No, I just loved everything about it. And when it was like going to the cinema, my mother tells me, I used to say, no, don't let's go to the Orpheus, let's go to the Odeon, because the curtains are so much nicer there. Mm. It was sensed that everything about the experience was important, and I suppose that's something I have kept alive in my writing, that it's not just what happens isolated on a stage, removed from the audience, but an entire experience. And I find when critics write about the theatre, I always find it disappointing that they don't acknowledge that maybe they had a toothache, or they had a difficult journey to get to the theatre, or that they had a row with their wife before they came, or, you know, whatever, in an uncomfortable seat while somebody was using a mobile phone three seats away. These are the sort of things that, to me, matter as much. In fact, they're what make live performances what they are. They're distinctive because they're not predictable. They're not like a film shown on a screen which is unalterable. And that's the thing that I've probably, you know, always played on when I've been writing and writing plays.
Okay. Now, at the same time during your childhood, do you ever remember going to some more straight plays, just straight drama, whether just comedies or anything else? And if so, if not, when was it that you first started going to theatre like that?
It's difficult to remember. Everything's difficult to remember. It gets worse. Laurence Olivier said to me that he could remember his early experiences, but he can't remember last year. Mm. I haven't found that. I've found that it's fading and fading and fading. And you know, the more I try and remember, the more I falsify it, so that life then has become almost fictional, especially because it was the war. I was 12 when the war started and 18 when it ended. So my entire adolescence was spent in a blacked-out wartime city, in a Europe that was blacked out. The whole of Europe was blacked out, except Portugal. Mm. And it's difficult to remember exactly when things happened. I do know certain things because I've traced them into history books, in records of the theatre and so on. Mm-hmm. So that I know I saw a pantomime at the Lyceum when I was five, because I know the date and it's in the books. But it's very difficult to otherwise. I think Peter Pan is the first play I remember, if you could call that a play, because it's half a pantomime. Mm-hmm. It's one of the plays that was based on pantomime, and Bernard Shaw wrote some as well. But until then, I don't think pantomime had played much of a part in English drama, except perhaps Midsummer Night's Dream. It's got so many of the elements of pantomime in it. I think Peter Pan, and then when I started to read Shakespeare at school.
How old would you have been then?
In my early teens, I suppose.
Right. Okay.
Probably, 13, 14, or another. And saw it at the Old Vic. Before it was the Old Vic, actually, touring companies, and John Gielgud came, I think, in Hamlet, and I saw Macbeth, and I saw lots of Shakespeare.
Did the idea of the school trip exist then, whereby you'd be studying it in class and then everyone would troop off, or was this something on your own initiative or your parents?
I think it maybe was a school matinee. Yes, I seem to remember it was. Again, it's difficult for me because most of my associations with the Old Vic were when I was there at the drama school, which was after the war.
Yeah.
And so again, it's very difficult for me exactly to say. I do remember coming to London and seeing Phyllis Dixie, since you're on to censorship. Let's get on to Phyllis Dixie, because she was the only one who ever appeared nude on the stage, well, semi-nude,
right.
Usually, just the top.
Yeah.
And she was in a play called While Parents Sleep, which was scandalous at the time. And I remember going with either my parents or my uncle or something to see that. Why they chose to take me to that, I can't imagine. But it was, you got brief glimpses of breasts, because then, of course, you had strict rules about what you could do.
Mm-hmm.
And at the windmill, they used to, when they bared their breasts, they had to keep absolutely still. They couldn't move with bare breasts. They had to stand still. And if that rule was breached, they could be closed by the Lord Chamberlain or, more often, the local watch committee. Because one of the fears about getting rid of the Lord Chamberlain, the abolition of the Lord Chamberlain, one of the fears people had was that it would open you to much worse censorship by the local watch committee. A body of local bigwigs and busybodies who thought they knew better than us what we should see.
Interesting. Okay. Well, just going back a bit, I suppose, this project is primarily concerned with theatre from 45 onwards, and you're perhaps unusual in this, in that your first experience of performance during this, the beginning of this period, was actually in Singapore and touring Malaya with the Combined Services Entertainment. I'd just like to ask briefly, what kind of shows were you putting on there, and was there ever any short, straight drama that you put on, or was it primarily just musical entertainment?
No, we were assembled, our particular troupe. I mean, we were centred in an HQ on Singapore Island, and various parties were put together, mostly variety shows, or what was then called concert parties, which meant that, if they were, later we would have called them reviews, but they were halfway between a variety show and a review, and they included sketches and turns and singing and dancing and so on and so on. But we were put together primarily to do a play, which was called Not So Much the Heat, and I don't think anybody's ever heard of it since. But it was set in India, in the forces in India, and I imagine it was rather like it ain't half hot, mum. It was about a service unit in India, maybe during the war, maybe after the war. I can't remember now. I can't remember anything about it. I know that I had the young officer lead in it, and Stanley Baxter and Kenneth Williams were playing other parts in it, and the rest of the troupe were all playing parts in this, and it was a farce. It was a farce set in the services in India. Mm. And the saying that it came from was, it's not so much the heat as the humidity. Mm. You know, and that's what makes it uncomfortable to be in the tropics, is what they were saying. So it was called Not So Much the Heat. So we started and we read it. We were assembled for it. We read it, and we had a good reading of it, and it was very funny, and we thought it was all going to be great. And then word came from London that we couldn't do it after all. The author had agreed to sign up for a London production, and therefore all the other productions were cancelled. Awful shame for him, because he didn't get anything at all out of it. It never got to London, as far as I know, or if it did, it quickly died. Anyway, that meant we were all left stranded without a show. Mm-hmm. So Stanley Baxter and Kenneth Williams and various others decided, let's do a review, and so that's what we did. We put together a show that was a review. So I was rather left out of it then, because I didn't have a turn to do. You know, I wasn't actually a comedian or a performer in that way. But in fact, I did have one, and it was the first writing, I suppose, of mine that was ever actually performed on stage, and it was called The Condemned Cell, and it foreshadowed some of my writing, I suppose, in the sense that it was a parody of a melodramatic monologue of a man in a condemned cell, you know, orating to himself, like the Count of Monte Cristo or something. And Kenneth Williams still remembered it. I'd completely forgotten it. And when he came on and did his show, you know, An Evening with Kenneth Williams, he started quoting screeds of it. Yeah. And it pointed me out in the audience, and I was going, I couldn't believe it. You know, I'm there looking bewildered on the edited version they did. But that was it didn't go in as a regular part of the show, because I almost immediately got went sick with amoebic dysentery, which I got several times. If you had it three times, actually, they sent you home. I had it twice, and then I had some residual intestinal complaint. I mean, I wasted away to nothing. I looked like Belson in the end. But that was how we did it. So then we toured Malaya and Singapore and Hong Kong with this review.
And can you remember, I'm interested in the audience reaction. Were people there because the soldiers, they had to be, or were they happy to kind of escape from the day-to-day monotony and happy to be entertained
by
you?
It depended where it was. I mean, if we were in a place where there was other entertainment, cinemas and things, no, nobody came. But if it was in some remote unit where we did go, you know, then it you'd get an audience. And I mean, after all, they were seeing Kenneth Williams and Stanley Baxter, you know, who would be future big stars.
Yeah.
Though it was a terrible show, really, I mean, I'm sure it was much worse than I represented in Privates on Parade. I mean, that show has got very little to do, the one in Privates on Parade has got very little to do with the show, in fact, that we did. Though some of the atmosphere of it, the opening chorus and things like that, were very much borrowed from CSE. But when Stanley went to see Privates, he said he went in fear and trembling in case he'd be revealed as a terrible ham or something. And he said, actually, I'm disappointed because it was nothing very much like the show we did, you know.
Interesting. Okay. Now, when you came back to Britain, you went into theatre training, into actor training at the Old Vic in Bristol. Now, how useful a training do you think that was for an actor? And what kind of aspirations did you and your contemporaries have? Was it the aspiration to stay and act at the Old Vic, or to make it in London, or touring a repertory? What was seen as the kind of end goal of it?
Well, my goal was never to be an actor. I went to Bristol Old Vic because there were no courses for playwrights. Hmm. You know, there were no university drama courses in. There were no university courses in drama. In fact, Bristol was probably one of the earliest. And they did, in fact, establish certain theatre studies at Bristol long before I think there was a department of theatre studies. So that people like Glyn Wickham, who later became professor of drama at the university there, used to come and lecture us at the Old Vic School on theatre history and so on. Mm. We were housed in a fruit warehouse, above a fruit warehouse. It was like an isolated building, a red brick building, amongst quite a lot of bomb damage. Mm. because remember, this was 1948. You know, Bristol wasn't rebuilt any more than any other city. It was rebuilt for years. They were too busy building houses for the ex-servicemen and people who'd been bombed out to bother with the centre of cities. So the centre of cities tended to stay as more or less as they were for 10 years or more. In fact, I don't think they started on the real rebuilding of Bristol till quite late in the 50s. So we were in the middle of Bristol, in the old part around King Street, and the theatre's stage door was just across the road, and we were in this fruit and vegetable warehouse. So we would go in the morning and pick our way through all the fruit and vegetables and climb the stairs, you know, while they were all throwing cabbages about. And there was our classroom up there, and then the other classroom was across the road in a church hall which was beside the theatre. And then the great advantage of it was that we were allowed then, before Equity got onto it, to take part in the Bristol Old Vic productions. Mm. So, you know, as students, and it was great for them because they had a free supply of crowds. So when they were doing something like Julius Caesar, it was terrific. So they had this, like...
So you wouldn't get paid at all?
No, we didn't get paid. No. We were just terribly happy to be on the stage. You know, right. We couldn't wait. And I appeared in quite a few productions there. And can you stop it for a minute? Mostly non-speaking. We did have little parts. Okay, ready to go again?
Okay, well, you were just talking and showing some photos there of some of the walk-on parts and crowd scenes that you did at the Old Vic when you were a student. Did the students ever mix with the leading actors at all? Did you get to talk to them or...
Yeah, in some cases had affairs with them. Mm-hmm. Not in my case, unfortunately, but some of the girls particularly. I mean, it was rather good for the actors to come down to Bristol and find a ready supply of young women who were adoring them and, you know, couldn't wait to get in with them. I think we had quite a lot of conversations with them. I mean, I had quite a lot of conversations with George Kalouris and got to know him, which was exciting to me because he'd been in the Mercury productions of Orson Welles and he was in the film Citizen Kane and, you know, he was, for me, a big film star. And he had come straight from Hollywood to the Old Vic. And I afterwards assumed that he was probably going to be investigated for anti-American activities. Mm-hmm. Good few of them are coming over then.
I see, yeah. And there wasn't any sniffiness then about, on behalf of these leading actors, about mixing with the local students?
No, not really. No. They were pretty adaptable. And I afterwards played, of course, as an actor once I'd left the Old Vic school. Mm. I went back quite often and played in productions.
Mm. You know. Well, I was going to move on to that, about your career as an actual actor in repertory theatre. You said at the beginning when I asked about the Old Vic that you never wanted to be an actor, and yet you did spend 3 or 4 years, I guess, touring in various plays.
About five, actually. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and playing in television, early television, but mostly in rep. But I never really pursued it with any great, you know, enthusiasm, because, I mean, as far as I was concerned, it was mainly... I enjoyed doing it. I always enjoyed acting. I was never nervous. I never had stage fright or anything like that. I loved doing it. I felt very natural on the stage. And but in those days, it was very difficult to get a young actor who was a character actor. You know, you had to play juvenile. If you were a juvenile, you had to play juvenile. Mm-hmm. You had to play straight. You know, and I wasn't very good at playing straight. I wanted to play, you know, comic parts and that sort of thing. And when I got the chance, I usually did pretty well.
Right.
And, you know, playing in things like The Alchemist and, you know, sort of small parts and clown parts and, you know, comedy parts and that sort of thing. I didn't really pursue it with any great enthusiasm because I always wanted to be a playwright. Mm. And that's what I was doing, really. While I was resting, I was playwriting.
Did you act... You say that you were acting in television as well. Was that to make ends meet? Could you make ends meet just by the theatre acting? Or was that
no, I couldn't
were...
really. I was living on money, partly on money that my father had given me when I was 21. Mm. He was a frugal man and he'd saved £500 in national savings certificates, which was a lot of money then. And he'd done it for me and my brother. And he gave it to us when we were 21. But being frugal, He didn't give it to us. He doled it out to us, rather like a pension. So every time I wanted any more money, I had to write and ask him for it. You know, it was typical of a miser, because he was a miser, but he was also a generous miser.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to be an oxymoron, but it happens. You know, you can have a generous impulse. I'll look after the boy. I'll give him some money to see him through. But I better not give it to him all at once, because he could squander it.
You know. On his terms.
What?
On his terms.
Yeah, on his terms, exactly. A gift on his terms. And endlessly remind, you know, why don't you show more gratitude, boy, and all that. But anyway, no, I couldn't support myself as an actor, particularly not as I had to live in London and pay rent. Mm-hmm. I shared flats mostly with other young actors and aspiring people, you know, various kinds. Mm-hmm. People who were aspiring to be playwrights or actors. We none of us had much money, but we did manage to live in places now that, you know, you couldn't live at all, like Notting Hill Gate and Kensington, you know. We were, because things were different, you know. We paid like £3 a week in rent, but even that, you know, was hard to come by. Mm-hmm. Equity minimum was £5
a week, right?
So, and then you didn't get paid for rehearsal either, or you got £3 for £3-4 for rehearsal maybe. So if you did a special week, you know, in a rep, you'd get £10. Mm. And after that, you'd have to keep your flat in London and also pay digs where you were.
I see.
So it was pretty... it wasn't very viable economically.
Right. Was television better paid, or was it...?
Yeah, not that much better. I mean, what was extraordinary about television then, that people can't really believe, is that we used to go in and do it on... Say we'd do it on Sunday night, live, because there was no recording. I'm talking about the 50s, early 50s. And then you'd go in again and do it on Thursday. I mean, the repeat would be another performance.
I never realised that.
There was no such thing as a recording, of course, you know.
Yeah, of course.
So we'd do a kind of dress rehearsal in public for the audience on Sunday night. Then we'd go and repeat it on Thursday and get it right. And everything had to be done. It was all done on the move. So that when I started writing for television, I had to write in scenes where people had the opportunity to get across the studio. So if they played a scene in one place, and then the next scene they were wearing slightly different clothes in another location, I had to write in a bit that would cover them getting across the studio, putting on a different coat, getting into the new set, and the cameras wheeled around and found them.
You were working this out as you went along. It was just part of the natural process of writing to bear all this
in mind. Because I knew how it was done, because I was an actor.
Well, that does bring me on to another question, which is that, obviously, you spent time acting. You once met John Osborne, I think, who also used to act before he turned to playwriting, and I know Pinter acted. Do you think... what do you think that experience brought to you when you did start writing plays for the stage?
I suppose it gave you... I mean, I've been asked that before, and I think it's... all of us who were playwrights, I think, were more theatre people than people realise. We were theatre people. We weren't just playwrights. We'd been actors. You know, I didn't find it difficult to direct. I knew what had to be done. I knew all the aspects of theatre. But then I'd grown up knowing them somehow. I mean, when I went to the pantomime, I was just as interested in the fact that they were changing the colour wheel on the balcony. Mm. Or how did they, you know, how did they do the flying? You know, how were the ropes arranged? And, you know, and the front cloth, when the front cloth comes down and is covered in adverts, that sort of thing. And I loved all that. I loved all aspects of it. And I suppose eventually it's meant that I'm now disillusioned with it, and I don't really like it anymore. I don't really like all those aspects, because I wore out my passion for them. I was what was then called stage struck, which meant not just the drama, but every aspect of it.
Right. That's interesting that you say you were interested in the whole total control of the theatre, but you didn't really direct much. I know you directed Born in the Gardens in Bristol, but you didn't, unless I'm wrong, direct any other of your plays, did you?
Yes,
you...
I did. I directed Blue Murder. Blue Murder, both at the Tobacco Factory and in the national tour. I co-directed, though I'm not really credited, but I really did co-direct A Piece of My Mind. But I gave the credit for these things very often to the director. And I think this quite often happened with authors who were so closely allied to the production that they didn't want to claim part of the director's credit, you know. But you could very often have said they were co-directors. I directed a revival of Joe Agate Greenwich. I directed a revival of Forget Me Not Lane. I directed the National Health in Minnesota. So I did about six, really, productions. But, I mean, I would like to have done more, but I didn't get interested in it early enough to really make it affect my career. It was only quite late in life that I began to think. And it was actually Born in the Gardens that did it, because when they said, would you do a play for us to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the Theatre Royal, I said yes, on condition that I can direct it. So then I wrote a play that I knew I could direct, which was one set, four characters.
Well, going back now just to the mid-50s, I mentioned briefly that you met John Osborne while you were both actors. Do you have any memories of meeting him then, or is it really things that you superimposed afterwards, knowing what happened?
No, I remember seeing him, and I've got this in my autobiography. I mean, I remember seeing him in, I think it was The Reluctant Debutante, where he played a butler, part previously played by someone like Wilfred Hyde White in the West End. And then, of course, all reps did only what was in the West End. He did productions afterwards for the West End plays. Very little new drama, and most of it modelled on West End lines. So John was in that, and I thought he was terribly good, very interesting as an actor, because he had this snarling voice, you know, and very scathing sort of personality. And I thought he was terrific, you know, and I really liked him. He was very unusual. And I was talking to Pat Sands, who was the director of the company. This was at Frinton-on-Sea. The under-30s theatre company, which we were still. However, whatever age we played, you know, we could play 70-year-old men, we'd still be, you know, putting grey on our hair. You know, what, God knows what it must have looked like. Anyway, then we, and John was in this, and I was talking to Pat Sands, Patricia Sands, who was a director, a woman who afterwards became the producer of The Bill. And she said, we're thinking of getting rid of John. And I said, why? He's terribly good. And I don't know whether it was anything to do with my response, but anyway, they didn't get rid of him. He stayed on. And when I told John this years later, he was very upset by it. I thought he would be pleased. Yeah. But you know, I don't think he liked the fact that he could probably say that I kept the job because I had put in a good word for him. But we played together in See How They Run, farce, in which we are next to each other in the programme as whatever part I played, Lieutenant Corporal, something rather like that, you know, Lance Corporal, something. And John is the intruder, which I think is wonderful. He's just called the intruder. It's such a wonderful prediction of what he was going to be in the theatre when he started writing. The intruder, you know.
Do you still have that programme?
Yeah.
You still actually have it?
Yeah.
Well, moving on a couple of years, obviously one of the main events that seemed to have kick-started new British writing was Look Back in Anger by John Osborne. Can you remember how soon it was before you were aware that this was going on at the Royal Court?
Long time. And I was at home in Bristol for some reason or other, on one of my frequent visits to have my laundry done, I expect. And I looked at a copy of The Stage, because, of course, we all took The Stage newspaper then to find out what jobs were available, what new productions were coming on. You had to, like, I see actors still doing it. They sell The Stage all around here now. You know, everybody buys it because there's so many actors here. But I bought The Stage and I saw this review of this play called Look Back in Anger, which I don't think it was a good review at all. I think it was a very bad one, like most of them. I mean, they were so offended by it. It's hard to see now quite why they were so offended, but they were. And I thought, John Osborne, I know that name. It actually wasn't very many years afterwards. When was it, 58?
56 was
56 yeah. was the premiere.
May 56.
56, so it was only about... could only have been about 4 years after I appeared with him. Mm. It was probably 52, 53 that I appeared with him. So I should have remembered better. But we didn't know each other very long, and we didn't get very close at all at that time. You know, it was only later in life that we got to be friends.
Right.
I only appeared with him in a couple of shows. He was mostly off doing something or other smart and glamorous that I didn't know anything about. He certainly advised me against the girl I was going out with at the time and said she wasn't my sort at all. But then he thought I was a gypsy. He put it in his autobiography. He said he seemed more like a gypsy to me than anything. Can't imagine that I'd ever occur to anyone to be a gypsy. Anyway, well, that was that.
So
then I went to see the play eventually, but it was a long time afterwards. I wasn't really very alive to it all, you know. I came very slowly alive to what was happening at the Royal Court.